From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. President Bush has never vetoed a bill from Congress, but he has quietly claimed his authority to bypass more than 750 laws that he's signed since he took office. He's done this by writing addendums to new laws known as presidential signing statements. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the reporter who broke this story, Charlie Savage, legal correspondent for the Boston Globe. After his report was published, Senator Arlen Specter, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said he would hold an oversight hearing in June. Also, we meet guitarist and singer Romeo Stoddart of the band The Magic Numbers. When their album was released last year, Jim Fusilli in the Wall Street Journal wrote, "To call it the debut album of the year might not be praise enough." That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush has never vetoed a bill. But as it turns out, the president has constitutionally challenged more than 750 laws enacted since he took office, and he's claimed the authority to bypass those laws. He's done this by writing addendums to new laws called presidential signing statements. This story was first reported at the end of April by my guest Charlie Savage, legal affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe. Since then, several newspapers, including the New York Times, have written editorials criticizing the president for his extensive use of these signing statements. And Senator Arlen Specter, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, decided to schedule an oversight hearing in June. President Bush has written more signing statements than any other president in history. While he's written 750, his father, George H.W. Bush, wrote 232 in his 4 years in office, and President Bill Clinton wrote 140 in his 8 years as president. I asked Charlie Savage to explain what a signing statement is.
A signing statement is not a proclamation in which he says, "This is a great bill, this is going to help America, thank you, Congress, for your hard work." He also issues those with great fanfare. A signing statement, in contrast, is a technical legal document which he files in the Federal Record on the day that he signed a bill. It contains his interpretation of what the law means and what it doesn't mean, and instructions to the federal bureaucracy or the military about how they are to implement the law now that it's taking force. Often in these signing statements, he is making constitutional objections to statutes and provisions that he thinks intrude on his own powers as the commander-in-chief or the head of the executive branch to run the government as he sees fit. He has challenged more than 750 laws in the last 5 years, saying that the executive branch can ignore all of them because, in his view, they conflict with the Constitution.
And he hasn't usually challenged the whole laws, but rather sections of the laws?
Well, this is a problem of nomenclature. You know, if you have a giant bill that is thousands of pages long, contains many different laws within it, many different statutes within it. Sometimes you refer to the whole thing as a law, but in fact it has, each section is a law in and of itself. And the Supreme Court might, for example, strike down one law as unconstitutional, but the rest remains.
Is there any pattern to the laws that the president has written signing statements for?
Many of the laws that he has challenged involve rules and regulations for the military and national security. Most famously, he has challenged the constitutionality of a law that forbids U.S. interrogators from using torture or other forms of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment against detainees anywhere in the world. He said that as commander-in-chief, only he has the power to set aside that torture ban if he thinks it would assist in preventing terrorist attacks. He's also, however, challenged a range of laws which have nothing to do with national security. He's challenged numerous statutes requiring congressional oversight committees to be given information about how the government is conducting a certain area of its business. He's challenged affirmative action provisions that require the government to try to make sure that minorities receive a share of contracts and grants and jobs. He's challenged whistleblower statutes, which allow members of the executive branch to speak out about government wrongdoing without fear of losing their jobs if they tell Congress about it. He said that only he, as the head of the executive branch, can decide what information Congress receives. He's challenged safeguards against political interference in federally funded research. All these things have nothing to do with national security, but are also the kinds of laws that President Bush has said over the last 5 years he's not bound to obey.
One of the laws that he issued a signing statement for included the creation of an inspector general for Iraq, and this is somebody who has oversight on how money is being spent in Iraq and how projects are developing. The president wrote that the inspector shall refrain from investigating any intelligence or national security matter or any crime the Pentagon says it prefers to investigate for itself. But isn't part of what the inspector general is investigating the Pentagon itself and how it's using money?
That's correct. The Congress set up a broad-ranging inspector general. In fact, they did this twice, once for the initial phase of the occupation and then again after the formal transfer of power. Congress set up an inspector general position that would have the power to go around and uncover any kind of wrongdoing by U.S. forces and U.S. officials in Iraq. And they specifically said that no official could get in the way of any inquiry, investigation, or subpoena that this inspector general wanted to issue. And in one case, also, that if anyone over there tried to interfere in any way or did not cooperate with this person's inquiries, he was immediately to tell Congress about it. When President Bush signed the bills containing these Inspector General statutes, he, first of all, as you read, severely curtailed what kinds of investigations this Inspector General could look at. And secondly, he said that the Inspector General could not, of his own will, tell Congress anything without the permission of the president and his appointees.
So isn't that kind of like saying if the president doesn't want the Inspector General to investigate the Pentagon, it can ask the Pentagon to investigate itself instead?
That's right. It's a way to keep the Inspector General from being a free agent who might conduct some kind of investigation that would get out of control from what the president and his appointees wanted to have investigated. In the context of the second law with the Inspector General, in fact, was 5 months after the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal. And it was a part of a large set of new rules and regulations that Congress passed for the next time they made a major military bill in response to that scandal. One of them was this Inspector General law. Another was saying that prison guards around the world in the military had to be retrained in the Geneva Conventions and the limits on the treatment of prisoners, the humane treatment of prisoners. A third was that the Pentagon had to create stronger rules for the use of private contractors, including conducting background checks on private contractors and barring them from any sort of criminal justice role. And of course, part of the Abu Ghraib scandal was the use of private contractors as interrogators. All of those rules and regulations that Congress passed in that bill were flagged by President Bush, who said that despite what the Constitution said Congress could do as far as passing rules and regulations for the military, only he, as Commander-in-Chief, could make such restrictions, and so he could ignore those laws.
President Bush is the first president in modern history who has never vetoed a bill. He's also set a record for the number of these presidential signings, over 750 of them, more than any other, hundreds more than any other president. Do you think that there's any relationship between the fact that he's never vetoed a bill and that he has a record number of these presidential signings that basically say, I don't have to follow certain provisions within the law?
It is certainly a very interesting pattern to put alongside each other. You know, one of the mysteries of this administration for the past 5 years has been, why has President Bush never vetoed a bill? Why is he the first president since Thomas Jefferson to go this far without using that power, when in every other respect he seems to be unusually aggressive about protecting his executive powers and expanding them? When you read these signing statements going back for 5 years and you deconstruct what it is that they're talking about, it starts to become clear that, in a way, these are better than vetoes because, first of all, one can use them to take out selected bits and pieces of the bill that one does not like while keeping the rest, whereas in a real veto, you have to take it all or get rid of it all. Secondly, Congress has the power to override a real veto, which is one of the checks and balances that the founders put into the Constitution. A signing statement is a unilateral final word on what's going to count and what might as well not have been in the law in the first place. And the third way in which a signing statement is more powerful than or more attractive to a president than the veto power that the Constitution gives him is that in practice, signing statements generally pass without notice in the public, the media, and the Congress. Nobody reads these things, such that you could see that if President Bush vetoed the torture ban, he would have faced some political flack for that, a great deal of political flack from that. But by doing it in a signing statement, he was able to do it almost without notice.
And with these signing statements, does the president basically reserve the right to be the final arbiter of what is constitutional, as opposed to letting that question be settled by the courts?
Yes, and this is one of the ways in which President Bush's use of the signing statements is different than what has come before, in addition to the fact that he's crushed all previous records in terms of the frequency with which he's challenging laws. He's also doing so largely in areas that will never get into court, areas such as national security, in which there's not going to be a plaintiff who has standing to sue and therefore to get a question before the Supreme Court.
So do you have any idea who the president informs after he issues a signing statement? Does he tell the agencies that are involved with the statement? Does he tell Congress? Does Congress know when Bush has a signing statement that he appends to legislation?
Congress could know if they chose to look. The signing statements are public documents. They are filed in the Federal Record. If one wanted to, one can go download them all and laboriously read through them, as I did. But by and large, Congress has not chosen to do that, or even thought to do that, because these have not been a normal part of our government system until now, to this degree. That does not mean that inside the executive branch, people are not paying very close attention to them. Because if you're ordered to carry out a law in a certain way, you can look to the signing statement for instructions. Outside the executive branch, though, until recently, very few people even knew these existed.
How does President Bush's use of these signings compare to a line item veto?
Well, some would argue that he has, in fact, used these as a line item veto, an override-proof line item veto. Technically, the line item veto that Congress tried to create in the 90s, in which the Supreme Court ruled was unconstitutional, was a more public document, and it was aimed more at financial matters, budget lines, than substantive law, like these are aimed at. The way that worked was President Clinton would say, I don't think we should spend, you know, whatever, $250 million on a bridge to nowhere. He would strike it out and send it back to Congress, and then Congress would have notice that he had done that and a chance to override it. Even despite that check and balance built into it, the Supreme Court said, no, it's unconstitutional. The way the Constitution works is Congress writes an entire bill and the president either takes it or he leaves it. He has to veto the whole thing or accept it all. So this seems to be something like a line item veto on substantive grounds, in the sense it's not, he's not knocking out money for things. He's knocking out restrictions on what he can do or regulations for the military and the executive branch that he thinks are his prerogative only to foster. But he's saying, you know, this section, which would be turned into this statute, no, the rest is okay. In that sense, it is like a line item veto, except Congress doesn't generally have notice that he's done it, and they have no chance to override his judgment.
My guest is Charlie Savage, legal affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charlie Savage, legal affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe. We're talking about a story that he recently broke. President Bush has issued 750 signing statements, addendums to new laws, in which he claims the right to bypass those laws by challenging their constitutionality. Do you know what the process is that the president goes through before issuing a signing statement? Who does he consult with? Who actually writes it?
Yes. Obviously, President Bush himself is not reading long bills and singling out provisions that conflict with his interpretation of the Constitution. Within the White House, there is an office called the Office of Management and Budget, which oversees the crafting of these things. And they farm out bills to all the various agencies which will be affected by the bill. And they also have lawyers within the White House Counsel's Office and in the Justice Department, the Office of Legal Counsel, who are also charged with reviewing these laws and flagging these provisions. And then sometimes they argue amongst themselves about what should go in and what should go out. And eventually, there's a final signing statement that's drafted up for the president to sign. So in a sense, this is President Bush doing these. It's certainly in first person, and it's his signature on it, and it's his approval that makes it work. But behind the scenes, it is the product of his legal team. This is the same legal team which has had a very aggressive view of presidential power in other aspects that we've seen over the last 5 years, including the famous torture memo, in which the team came up with the theory that President Bush, or any president as the commander-in-chief, could set aside a pre-existing torture ban, an older torture ban, in the interest of national security, or could authorize interrogators to use whatever techniques he felt necessary despite the ban. That memo was a secret, and then after the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, it was leaked, and it caused such an uproar that the administration had to set it aside. It's the same lawyers that are drafting things like that that are also drafting these signing statements.
Well, speaking of Abu Ghraib, you write that 5 months after the Abu Ghraib story broke, Congress passed a series of new rules and regulations for military prisons. The president signed that and then said he could ignore them.
That's right. Congress passed a series of new laws in reaction to the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal about 5 months later. The laws did such things as require the retraining of military prison guards around the world in the humane treatment requirements of the Geneva Conventions. It required the military to perform background checks on the contractors that they had to assist them, because, of course, contractors were some of the interrogators at Abu Ghraib, as opposed to people who were actually in uniform. It also required contractors to be banned from most criminal justice functions, which would keep them out of places like Abu Ghraib. And it set up an inspector general who was to be charged to look wherever he wanted in Iraq, and that no one would be allowed to interfere with whatever investigations that he wanted to launch. Bush challenged all of these laws. He said that only he, as commander-in-chief, could set rules and regulations for military contractors or decide what kind of training prisoner guards needed to have. And he declared that the inspector general shall not investigate anything to do with intelligence, national security, or anything that the Pentagon had decided that it would investigate itself.
What's the writing like in these statements?
It's extremely difficult to deconstruct. It is not, President Bush does not say, I'm the commander-in-chief, I have to protect national security, so regardless of what Congress says, I can waive the torture ban. It's full of language terms like the unitary executive theory. The executive branch shall construe this clause consistent with my constitutional authority to, you know, run the unitary executive and as commander-in-chief of the armed services. And you're saying, well, what does that mean? And eventually you recognize the code words for I'm the commander-in-chief, or I have absolute control over executive branch officials, and Congress cannot fracture that control, despite numerous Supreme Court rulings from the 30s to the 80s saying that Congress can, in fact, give executive branch officials independence. So it's not something that can be done easily. And in addition, it does not say, you know, this provision says I can't torture, but I can. It says, you know, Section 506 pertains to the treatment of detainees or purports to require information. And you have to go and look at those sections and you realize, oh, this is the torture ban, or, oh, this is a whistleblower statute. And so even though they are public documents, they're written in very vague ways and in very dense ways, which interferes with the ability, I think, of people to easily grasp what they're talking about, which may explain in part why Congress paid so little attention to them over the last 5 years.
Well, your article has had, I think, quite a ripple effect. There have been editorials, including one in the New York Times. Senator Arlen Specter, who's the head of the Judiciary Committee, said he's going to hold an oversight hearing in June. Do you think that Senator Specter didn't know about the signings until you wrote about them?
I think that no one in Congress knew about the signings and paid any attention to them until first the torture ban. That was the one that really sort of caught everyone by surprise, and one had to explain what the signing statements were, in fact. And then there were a few senators who spoke out about that, saying, well, wait a minute, this isn't right. John McCain, John Warner, and Lindsey Graham, all Republicans, who had been principal sponsors of the torture ban. And then the issue receded again until I wrote about the Patriot Act signing statement, and that caused another flurry. But again, until that last Sunday piece which had the much greater details about dozens and dozens and dozens and the aggregate numbers, I think no one in Congress or otherwise had grasped the extent to which this has been a pervasive strategy by this White House to impinge on the power of Congress to write the laws of the country. And several lawmakers have even said, to the extent, you know, after the domestic wiretapping program, we had some indication that this particular president had a very aggressive view of his powers, especially his wartime powers, to set aside laws. But the extent of it is only now starting to sink in on the Hill, I think.
It seems almost paradoxical that President Bush has used hundreds more of these signings than any other president in history. But at the same time, he has, you know, a Republican majority in the House and the Senate. He's just put two appointees on the Supreme Court, so he has two of his own appointees in the Supreme Court, you'd think in some ways he'd be the president least likely to need these signings.
It is remarkable, given the political climate of this town and the control of both chambers of Congress by his fellow Republicans, that he has nonetheless adopted this very aggressive strategy. It shows the degree to which he, and with him Vice President Cheney, are interested in pushing a very powerful presidency and expanding the power of the president to run the government as he sees fit. Now, Vice President Cheney, who came out of the Ford administration following Watergate, has said in public repeatedly that he thinks that the powers of the president were eroded after Watergate, that it went too far, and that part of his agenda is to restore the power of the president, to leave it stronger than it was when he took office. In the fight over his Energy Task Force papers, we saw one aspect of that, which is expanding the degree of the White House to control information and to shield information from the public in order to free itself to do what it wishes more in a more unrestrained manner. These signing statements are another major prong of that strategy, it is clear.
Charlie Savage is legal affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Growing Girls, The Mother of All Adventures, a memoir by Jean Marie Laskus, author of The Exact Same Moon. From Turner Classic Movies, presenting Race and Hollywood, Black Images on Film, a 38-film retrospective with discussion and commentary Tuesday and Thursday nights in May. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. What she gonna do now?
Now that she knows he's in on me. Coming up, catchy harmonies and hooks from the band The Magic Numbers. We talk with singer, guitarist, and songwriter Romeo Stoddart. And we continue our conversation about President Bush's signing statements with Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Charlie Savage, legal affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe. We're talking about the story he recently broke. President Bush has issued over 750 signing statements, addendums to new laws in which he claims the right to bypass those laws by challenging their constitutionality. After Savage's story was published, Senator Arlen Specter said he would hold an oversight hearing in June. I'm wondering if you know if any Republican members of Congress see the president's signings as a threat against congressional power, and if Republicans in Congress now think that the president is expanding presidential power at the expense of Congress.
Well, certainly Senator Specter has said exactly that. When I talked to him on a week ago, and he announced that he was going to have this hearing next month. He said that this is a fairly blatant violation of the separation of powers and a slap in the face to Congress, essentially, Congress's power to write the laws, and that Senator Lindsey Graham, earlier during the torture debate, also said he did not think any elected official, including the president, had the power to set aside a law that had been duly enacted. So this is a theme which is starting to be picked up even among Republicans on the Hill.
Has the White House had any response to your articles about the president's signings?
When I was preparing, as I said, the Torture Act story back in January, the torture ban story, I was able to get on the phone with an attorney in the White House, have a genuine conversation about what was being said here and why. After that, they've been very uninterested in explaining themselves any further. They have a talking point that each time I call them and I say, okay, I'm doing another story on this, what would your response be? Or would you like to talk about it? The talking point is previous administrations have done this as well, and the president intends to faithfully follow these laws in a manner that is consistent with the Constitution. Both of those talking points, of course, are misleading, because the president intends to follow a law in a manner consistent with the Constitution means he intends not to follow the law if he thinks it's inconsistent with the Constitution, and he's affording himself the right to interpret the Constitution as he sees fit. And previous presidents have done this, that's true, but no previous president has done this anywhere near as frequently or as aggressively as this president. And no previous president has done this while also abandoning their veto power.
One of the stories you're covering now is the president's nomination of Michael Hayden to head the CIA. Now, Hayden headed the National Security Agency when the president authorized the NSA to eavesdrop on the phone calls of Americans speaking to suspected terrorists abroad. And the president says that his wartime powers gave him the right to ignore the 1978 Surveillance Act that requires warrants. Do you think that in the confirmation hearings for Michael Hayden, that questions about the president's signings will come up, or you know, larger issues about the president's interpretation of his own right to judge what is constitutional?
Certainly, a number of lawmakers have already said that the nomination of General Hayden to be the director of the CIA presents a new opportunity for Congress to find out more about how the domestic wiretapping program works and whether, in fact, it is illegal. Senator Spector, the Republican who heads the Senate Judiciary Committee, has had four hearings attempting to answer these questions, and the administration has essentially stonewalled him. And he's complaining that he just does not know how to do his job. It is his job to ascertain whether the president has gone too far here. He's not been given the information to do that. With the nomination of General Hayden, who devised the program, implemented it for President Bush, and became one of its chief defenders and its public face after the program's existence was disclosed in December, Congress has a new opportunity to return to the question of the spying program. Now, several months ago, when this was a hot issue initially, the question of whether or not a president has the power to set aside a law because we're at war and he has wartime powers was obscured, because the rhetoric shifted to, is this program a good idea or not? And anyone who was critical of the program was positioned as being soft on terrorism. You don't want to listen to Osama bin Laden's phone calls. That was not the point, and it is not the point. The point is it a good idea for a president to have the power to set aside a law in secret whenever he thinks doing so would help national security? But that's a complex question, and it's harder to convey that than it is it a good idea to listen to Osama bin Laden's phone calls? So we will see in the Hayden confirmation hearing whether the skeptics about the program, the skeptics about the legality of the program, separate from the merits of the program, are able to do a better job of conveying to the public what it is we're talking about, or whether they get sidetracked again by defenders of the administration who simply use it as a tool to beat them up for being allegedly soft on terrorists.
Are you going to continue to follow this story?
Well, I'm fascinated by this story. I think it's a good one. And with Senator Spector calling hearings next month, it certainly has one more month of legs in it. Beyond that, we'll see.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Charlie Savage is the legal affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe. You can find a link to his article about the president's signing statements on our website, freshair.npr.org. You'll also find there a link to a government website where you can search for the president's signing statements. Coming up, catchy hooks and harmonies from the Magic Numbers. We talk with songwriter and singer Romeo Stoddart. This is Fresh Air. The Magic Numbers had several top 20 hits in the UK. When their debut album was released in the States last year, rock critic Jim Fusilli wrote in the Wall Street Journal, "To call it the debut album of the year might not be praise enough." The Magic Numbers is made up of two sets of siblings. My guest Romeo Stoddart sings, plays guitar, and writes songs. He and his sister are originally from Trinidad, then moved to New York, then London. Their song Love Me Like You went to number 12 in England. It's got catchy hand claps and backup vocals. Let's hear what Romeo Stoddart has to say about writing it, then we'll hear it.
Actually, when I was writing the song, I had the sort of backing vocal in mind for this one. And in the bridge, there's this, like, it's like a real kind of intense building thing. And Michelle started, we had, like, Don't Fail Me Now is, like, the lyric. And it's kind of like, the you know, I'm sort of at the point where it's like breaking point, where it's like it's just really kind of getting to me kind of thing, and she's just building this line, don't fail me now, over and over, and it just adds to the kind of intensity. And I think lyrically the song was probably the most kind of difficult to bring to the band, mainly because it was like really personal and yeah, and I think they kind of felt like, you know, they didn't really talk to me about what the lyrics meant for ages. And they're like, okay. But yeah, but it's a great one to play live. I'm really proud of it.
Too personal for you to tell us about?
Well, it's just kind of, it was kind of, I used to be in a relationship with, for like 8 years, with Sean and Angela's sister.
Oh.
So, yeah. and so the song was kind of about, like, the end of that, but also, I was sort of now starting, like, a new relationship with someone. So it was kind of, and the line is, like, she don't love me like you. So it was kind of and I've never, you know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of like, I don't know, a little strange to talk about, but... But so certain songs, you know, are kind of harder to bring to the band, especially like at that point when our relationship had finished and stuff.
Wow, what a set of interconnections and complications.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's time to hear the song. This is "Love Me Like You," and this is the Magic Numbers. My guest Romeo Stoddart wrote the song and sings lead.
All those years gone by. Find a way to make it hard.
That's The Magic Numbers, Love Me Like You, from their CD, The Magic Numbers. And my guest, Romeo Stoddart, is the lead singer and the lead songwriter of the group, and he wrote the song that we just heard. Great, great song, great, great, great record. How did you name the band The Magic Numbers?
We had, like, a list of different names, and some were really, really awful. And
For example?
Well, myself and Sean were in a band for about 6 years before The Magic Numbers called Guess, and everyone we'd tell, like, so what's the name of your band? And we were like, Guess, and they were like, oh, well, I don't know, you know. And it was just like this, it was a silly joke at the start, but, like, you know, for that long a time using the name, it wasn't funny anymore. But, yeah, and I don't know, I just kind of thought The Magic Numbers just sounded like a real kind of classic name that no one had used before, and I was surprised because, I don't know, it just sort of said a real kind of, it had like a kind of gang mentality, like, I don't know, like the Rolling Stones, or, I don't know, like the Lovin' Spoonful, The Magic Numbers. I just really loved the name, and I thought it really worked in with our characters, like the four of us, just kind of represented something that I liked.
You and your sister grew up in Trinidad. How did your family first move there?
Well, my mum and dad were actually born in Trinidad. Mm-hmm. And so they had us there. And my granny's kind of Venezuelan, Guyanese. And my dad's Scottish. And yeah, I mean, I lived there till I was 11. And then I moved to New York, and I guess Michelle was about sort of 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it was, I guess it made us who we are, like living there and just kind of growing up as well, because there was this real sort of togetherness, like, I mean, everyone kind of knew each other, like where we lived, and it was just real kind of laid back, as you can imagine, living in the Caribbean beaches and like everyone just sort of chilling out and, as they would say, liming is like, you know, hanging out. And yeah, and I just had a lot of fun there. And then moving to New York was, I guess, the sort of huge eye-opener that I kind of needed at that point, which was, I just kind of felt like I could do anything then when I moved to, like, I'd be in Manhattan and I'd see, you know, and just see, like, this mad life that I kind of just only seen on TV in Trinidad and kind of never thought I would experience, so.
Now, I think when you moved from Trinidad, it was right after a failed coup.
Yeah.
Is that right? Was that a frightening time to be living in a country when there was a coup?
Yeah, it was really scary because I remember just, we had the TV on and this news presenter that I'd sort of grown up with, seen, you know, for years, like he had like a gun to his head and stuff, and it was a little bit like crazy. And then there was like a curfew, like I think it was 7 o'clock, and you couldn't leave the house unless you get shot. And they would have like these huge kind of almost, I don't know, like just these huge trucks with like 20 sort of people and, you know, to 20 guys with guns like driving around your house. And it was totally scary. And then our uncle had seen it on the news in New York and was like, look, you know, you guys should come over and sort of stay. You know, my business is doing really well. And, you know, and he was kind of doing huge sort of parties for like the Grammys and Madonna and all the, you know, he was kind of like a celebrity kind of florist designer kind of thing. And he was like, you know, come and work, ask like my mum and dad, and, you know, come and work with us and get away from Trinidad for a while. And we're like, yeah, okay, cool. And it's kind of, my parents are always very sort of like impulsive. And even now, like, you know, it's just like, okay, let's do that. And the next thing you know, we're living in New York.
So were you already writing songs at this point and interested in being in a band?
Yeah, I kind of, when I was even in Trinidad, like around sort of 8 or 9, my granny had a piano and she didn't play it anymore. And she would always say, oh, Romeo, go up on the piano and just kind of hit, you know, a couple white notes and a black note, make up a little song. And, you know, and so she kind of was the person that kind of got me into writing. So I would just make little songs up for her, like little tunes, and she'd be like, you know, she'd obviously love it because I was a grandchild, and then I found myself going to the piano even when she wouldn't ask me, and I would make little things up, and then when I moved to New York, I bought a guitar when I was like 15, just before moving to London, and that's when I guess I started writing words and really kind of thinking, okay, all my friends are in bands, and this bug that I've had for years, like, you know, from like 7 or something, of wanting to play music and just being obsessed with music, I just knew that it wasn't going to go. So I was like, I'm going to buy a guitar and I'm going to learn it, you know, master it.
So it sounds like you had a real musical family. Your grandmother encouraged you to write songs. Your mother used to get everybody singing when they came to the house. Your mother used to have, like, host a TV show in Trinidad. It sounded like a local version of Star Search or something.
It was kind of like that, but she didn't actually host it.
That's a mistake.
Yeah, she sort of appeared on the program for 5 weeks running, which was kind of unheard of at that time, because, you know, usually people just go on every week, but they loved her a lot, and people would vote her back and stuff, and she, I guess it was unheard of because it was predominantly kind of reggae or calypso that appeared on the show, and she sang like opera, so she would sing, like, now and again she'd sing like a Burt Bacharach song or Jimmy Webb song, but mostly it would be like Italian opera or something, which she still sings like around the house. I'm like, I don't even know what the hell she's singing, but it sounds great, you know? I'm like, okay, I don't even know if she does anymore, and she just knows the songs. But so kind of music was just always around, and then my other uncle, who I grew up with as well in Trinidad, he was really into country music, and that had a huge effect on me. Because, you know, I remember Patsy Cline, I Fall to Pieces, he would stick this record on all the time. He had like on a little 7-inch, and they would just sit around and they would cry their eyes out listening to this song. And I thought it was beautiful, and I, you know, I understood it or whatever, but it kind of just blew me away that they would sort of put this on, and all of a sudden the mood would change and everybody would be really, you know, sad and crying. And so I used to go and stick it on and listen to it, and I just kind of just felt, wow, you know, music's really powerful, and, you know, it just kind of stayed with me. And to be honest, whenever I hear that song now, because I knew it was one of my granny and my uncle's favourite songs, and they both passed away, and whenever I hear it, I always think back at that time, and it does kind of make me sad, so it's kind of gone sort of full circle, like.
My guest is Romeo Stoddart of The Magic Numbers. Here's another track from their debut album, The Magic Numbers.
You're in denial. You're in denial, and I know. Well, what's my name? Well, what's my name? I don't know. Baby, if it's our fault, maybe I can meet you in the morning. Call me if you're on your own, and maybe I can meet you in the morning.
We'll talk more with Romeo Stoddart of The Magic Numbers after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Romeo Stoddart of the Magic Numbers. He sings, plays guitar, and writes songs. His sister is also in the band. Their mother sang on TV in Trinidad when they were growing up. I guess you grew up in an atmosphere that made singing seem like just a really natural thing that everybody does.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, definitely. But funny enough, I didn't, although I would do it at home, like, my whole intention was kind of, you know, I was writing songs, but I was playing the guitar, and my whole thing was like, I just want to play guitar in a band. I wanted to be like, you know, growing up, I was into like Guns N' Roses, and I was like, yeah, you know, I'll be like Slash, you know, the cool guitar player in the back, and, you know, or whatever. And I didn't really want to ever sort of like front a band or be the singer or whatever.
You said you didn't really want to front a band. I just wanted to read you something. I don't know if you've seen this, that was written about the band in GQ. And this was like at the end of 2005 when your CD was released in the States. Chubby and hairy are not the words that usually come to mind when describing the latest IT rock act. But the Magic Numbers, this year's most exciting British band, certainly fit the description. What's your reaction when you hear that?
I kind of read that a lot. Like, I try not to read a lot of our sort of press, but whenever I come home, or like, you know, friends always say, oh yeah, check this out, this was in The Guardian or whatever, and you know, you read it, so, but, and that, you know, that comes up a lot, like, you know, they call us chubby and hairy, or, you know, the unlikely looking band or whatever, and I don't know, I somehow probably thought it would affect me more. But, you know, I am chubby and I am hairy, so, but, you know, so it's not like, I actually personally get a little bit kind of bored of just seeing bands and they all kind of look the same, and especially like we go places or you do like festivals and you've got like 50 other bands and they all look exactly the same, like modeled from, this is indie band number one, like this kind of haircut with like, yeah. You know, page one, like, you know, this tiny skinny tie and this kind of shirt and you walk a certain way. And it's like, it just gets a little bit kind of tedious, really. Whereas, you know, I think probably as well as our music being the sort of driving force of everything that's happened for us and especially the live shows, I think on the other side, I think it's probably been refreshing that, you know, we've kind of come out of nowhere and not, you know, had to adapt to anything. You know, it's kind of like, this is us, accept us, and that's it.
Well, I want to close with another track from your debut CD. And this track is called Long Legs, another one of the songs that you wrote. Do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
Long Legs was probably one of the first of the kind of faster songs that we were writing, and because before that we would do a lot of shows and it was kind of more stripped down acoustic guitar, and we had this girl playing violin and Sean would be on brushes and stuff, and then I kind of I play the banjo, and I love playing the banjo, like 5-string banjo, and I remember us just hanging out one night, myself, Sean, and our friend Steve, and in this nearby graveyard. Sounds kind of dark, but we were like, couldn't make noise at home, so we were like, oh, let's just like take some instruments, take like a mandolin and a bouzouki and the banjo, and let's just like go find a quiet spot. So we found, and this song came out of like a late night drinking session, like 4 a.m, and this song just came, and I was like, wow, this is great, and then kind of remembered it the next day, and then we started working on it, and it's a fun one to play live as well.
Did you teach yourself how to play banjo?
Yeah, like myself and my friend Steve, he plays banjo, so he showed me a few little things, but it's great for coming up with like little hooks, and like the guitar line in that, that's like a little banjo fill that I did, and then when I had to do it on the guitar, I was like, all right, cool, you know. So it's nice. I love writing on different instruments. Like when I write on the piano as well, it's nice to, because with the guitar, I kind of know it so well, so I know what chords to go to almost before I go to them. Like I can think, oh yeah, I'll do like a minor here or something, and my hand just kind of immediately does it. Whereas I find more little accidents and, you know, sort of it's a lot freer basically, like on other instruments.
Harder to slip into the more predictable thing on an instrument you don't know as well. Yeah, totally. Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. Thanks.
Romeo Stoddart of The Magic Numbers. Their debut album is called The Magic Numbers. Here's the track, Long Legs. I'm Terry Gross.
Long legs, don't give me no head rush in the morning. Oh, baby, too bad. I don't think I'll ever see your face again. But I don't want to lose your buzz. And I don't want to choose just one.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greater good. From BMW, where ideas are everything. And as an independent company, they have the freedom to let those ideas live on. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. And from Audible.com. Where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The popular historian Douglas Brinkley lives in New Orleans and teaches there at Tulane University. During the hurricane, he helped rescue people. When it ended, he vowed to start an oral history project documenting what happened. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Brinkley about his new book, The Great Deluge. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.